Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
I'm Mike Lameco from Food Talk. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, welcome to Japanese. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, a food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deeper understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I'll try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Stefan Ramirez, who is the founder and tea specialist at TeaDealers.com, which he started in 2005. And Stefan is also an experienced traditional tea practitioner of the Rasenke school. So today we'll talk about how Stefan got into tea and started his own tea company, how he established relationships with tea growers, his passion for tea ceremony, and much, much more. Hello, Stefan. Welcome to Japanese.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, so first of all, please tell us your background. So I heard that you worked in the fashion industry before you got into tea.
Yeah, I did. A lot of people ask me where I'm from. Mm. So I was actually born in Colombia. Mm. I lived there until I was two, and then I moved to Vienna, Austria.
Wow.
My mother liked to travel a lot, so we spent a good amount of time there, and I finally came to the States when I was 8 years old. Mm. I lived in a little town right outside of Manhattan. It's called Harrison, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. That's where I went to school. I went to New Jersey Institute of Technology for an engineering background. So actually, before fashion, my endeavor was actually to be in networking. And at the age of 19, I actually got an engineering job, which was a lot of fun. I thought that, you know, technology was where I wanted to be. Mm. But after having worked in that for about 3-4 years, the guy next to me asked me what the latest ACES motherboard was. Mm. And at that moment, that's when I realized that I didn't want my life to be that way. So I made a big jump, and I decided to, you know, quit my job, leave my apartment. I started living in the East Village, and then I started working in fashion. Mm. Funny thing is, through fashion, I had been working there for about 2-3 years and just developing my skills in sales and aesthetics and things like that. And then I found this tea company who needed a part-time salesperson. I thought it was kind of amazing when I first walked in, the way it was set up. It was almost like a laboratory, but it was totally unknown to me, like everything that I had seen. Mm. I applied, and then I dove head first into it, like really shortly after that. I had to take a tea specialist test, and they threw all this information at me, and I was really overwhelmed, but at the same time really stimulated and excited about learning about this really, really deep product that I had no idea about.
Wow. So it's a Japanese tea company?
Was yes.
Oh, okay. Wow. I'm curious. So can you say the name of the company?
No? Yeah, it's a very famous one, Itoen.
Oh, okay. They've been supporting us, so thank you, Itoen. Okay. So, right, but what was the moment that you really realized that tea has something special to you?
It was actually when I started studying for my first tea specialist test. Mm. You know, I was kind of going through the information and, like, you know, looking at the world consumption rates and the production rates, and how much American consumers were drinking and how, you know, lowly ranked America was, and the history, and, like, you know, reading about the Opium Wars and the Boston Tea Party. Mm. Like, my mind just started to race, and I just, like, started to realize how deep of a product I had just encountered. And I started to really take it in full seriousness. You know, there are methods of tasting. There are professional methods of rating tea. Mm. And this really, really stimulated, because in any direction that I decided to kind of study and further develop my knowledge, it was endless. You know, it's like, it's a, you know, it's like 2,000-year-old product. And I kind of realized that even if I got to live 100 years old, I would never fully understand everything. And that stimulates me.
Right. The more you learn, the more you know. You don't know.
And as you get older, your knowledge about it changes as well.
Mm. Okay. So your company, you started Tea Dealers. Mm-hmm. So what kind of motivation and how did you start the tea company?
So after my 2-year stint with the tea, Japanese tea company, I had left and I wanted to actually go back into retail and managing retail shops. I thought that would actually be a skill that would be really good for my future. I didn't exactly know what was going to happen, but 6 months into it, I got a call from one of my really, really close clients, and he said, "Stefan, we can't get the tea anymore that you used to sell, and, like, I don't know, we're just missing that aspect of it. Can you still acquire it?" And I said, let me try to see what I can do. So it just came about really, really naturally. I called a couple of people and said, "Hey guys, would you support me in this endeavor?" And they said, "Yeah, definitely, if you want to do it." And that's how it started, just really, really natural. It wasn't something that I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And they just kind of naturally pushed me into it. And so I started off privately. So I just had, like, just, you know, a few customers. It was through referral only. And it allowed me to really, really acquire, to learn about tea, specialty kinds of teas, only premium. I would, you know, I'd be able to travel to Japan and have clients that I was buying for, so there was no risk involved. Mm. But the amount that I got to learn, and just it was an adventure. It was really, really amazing to be able to do that.
Well, it sounds like you have a good patron kind of relationship with your customer.
Yeah, I was very, very lucky with that.
Right. Okay, so, and you just worked with all individuals,
yeah,
right, for a while.
Exactly.
And then, but now you have much more, the bigger scope of the business. So what kind of business do you do now?
Well, now it's, you know, educating the public. You know, I realized that I needed to reach out to more people. And premium tea, or, you know, high quality tea, doesn't necessarily mean it has to be crazy expensive. Mm. It has nothing to do with that. It has to be, it's more about who produces it and how much effort they put into making it, you know. So I wanted to just show people that part of tea, that you don't necessarily have to spend a lot of money, but it can, but you should kind of really care about what you're drinking.
Mm. Right. So Tea Dealers, which you started 2005, that's 11 years ago. Mm-hmm. Already. So you have import, distribute, or what's the scope?
Yeah, I import.
Okay.
Everything is abroad. My black teas come from one agent that I've known for a long time. His family owns a tea farm for a really, really long time, almost 40, 50 years. The market system in India is kind of different, so there's one agent. Everything is based on like a market, almost like the bidding system.
Okay.
So that it's fair, so that everybody can get tea.
Mm.
But I trust him, and I trust the kind of farms that he works with. Same thing in Japan. It's people who I've established relationships with, or I've come in contact with their product through somebody, and really natural that way.
Right. So I heard that you directly source your products.
Everything, yes.
From premium tea producers, right? So how did you find those producers and, establish good relationships with
them? It's a lot of legwork. a lot of lead work. It takes me months, sometimes years, to find somebody. When I start looking for someone, it's based on a taste that I'm trying to fulfill in my menu, not just a type. You know, there's a type, but then there's also what I consider to be an ideal representation of the region, of the quality of product that can come from that region. And so that search really takes me in really, really deep. And, you know, I'll come across maybe 25, 30, sometimes 50 different samples that I have to choose from. And, you know, sometimes I stop for a few months and then I continue my search. Sometimes I can find someone within like 3 months if they're, you know, if they're connected on the internet. But if they're not connected on the internet, it'll take me sometimes 3 years, sometimes 5 years.
Wow.
But I don't fulfill that gap until I find exactly who I'm looking for.
So the sounds like you have a target of a region or kind of certain types of tea. And
it's
then
the taste. It's really the taste.
Okay.
It's kind of like the same way that I shop for my jeans. I don't buy five blue jeans. I buy, you know, a dark blue jean, a gray and a black, or, you know, different colors. And I don't replace them until they've been worn out. So it's the same thing with tea. It's like there are certain tastes that I'm looking for that I know will really kind of make people react in a certain way that they've never reacted to. And that's what makes my selections really unique. The name may be something that you're very familiar with, but when you taste my tea, it's very different from anything you've ever tasted.
So you don't compromise.
There's no compromise, ever.
Right. Okay, so maybe you give us some example, like the Japanese producer example.
So I'm working with someone in Nara who his family has been producing tea for 9 generations, which is really amazing. They are basically one of the first families that started growing tea in Uji when, you know, like back in A size time. So it's really, really long time ago. About 60 years ago, they relocated to Nara, deep in the mountains, far away from highways. There is no public transportation, nothing. There's a forest. They cut out a grove, and that's where they grow their teas. This family, and when I say family, it's really the wife drives the truck, the husband's in the factory, producing every bundle that comes in. The son takes time off from college. He's in Shizuoka at the tea university. So he's the next generation, which is also very amazing. There's the younger sons. They get their friends involved, and everyone is there during tea production. But he only grows kabuse sencha, which means that he painstakingly goes through covering the tea for 15 days. He processes only 100% Yabukita, which is a single varietal. It's one of the first varietals that was created in Japan back in 1908. And he specializes just in that. And from that product, he gets different products, you know, like the kabuse sencha, of course, is the top grade, but then the coarse stems and leaves becomes his karigane or kukicha, which is a really familiar tea, but it comes from that grade.
Right.
He roasts the kukicha and it becomes hojicha, another everyday tea.
Right.
But again, it comes from that quality of tea. And when I first tasted his tea, I tasted the top line of it, but then I asked, can I taste the karigane? And the karigane is like an everyday tea. It's called the farmer's tea. And that's what the farmers drink. The farmers don't drink the high-end stuff because that's what they want to sell.
Right.
But, you know, like, karigane is really kind of like a representative of a Japanese way of thinking. You know, it's like motanai, never wasting anything. So the stems and the twigs and the coarse leaves get set aside, and that gets made into another product. But in that product, the heart of that Japanese expression, you can see that he puts so much effort into making that product special too, by baking it a little bit or whatever. So those are the kind of people that I want to work with.
So that's the whole essence of sustainable and very local.
Yeah. and just caring about every part of it, not just the really high-end stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that gives me leverage. So if someone can't afford the really, really high-end tea, mm-hmm. they can still enjoy a very everyday tea, and it's nothing less than right. the best they
yeah.
have to offer.
Actually, they're really unique, like a kukicha. It's right. roasty and I think less caffeine, too.
It depends. caffeine is a tricky situation. I don't like to talk about okay. caffeine because if some people are sensitive to caffeine, it's going to affect them either way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say because like in the morning you have a higher caffeine, like leafy one, mm-hmm. and maybe at the end of the day you can have coffee, yeah. but it doesn't work like that.
Exactly.
Sounds like
if it's good quality, it's going to be high in caffeine.
Okay,
higher.
All right, I have to remember that. All right, so. Yeah, then you have also, what kind of tea do you sell, by the way?
So five different countries, Japan, China, Taiwan, and Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And exactly like I said before, it's something that has a specific taste. Mm-hmm. I have greens, I have blacks, I have oolongs. I don't have any pu'er's yet. Pu'er is kind of like my next objective because it's going to take me a long time to research pu'er.
Because it's aged.
It's a category all on its own.
Right,
it is
okay.
really, really complicated.
Mm.
But I have, yeah, I cover all spectrums. Everything is based on a particular taste. So I want to give my customer an option to be like, oh, today I want to try this, and today I want to try that. Like I drink tea every day, so it needs to fit my mood. So one day I want just a simple hojicha, you know. So I have hojicha. Someday I want something really refined, so I have a competition tea, you know, and then everything in between.
Right.
It's really based on what I'm eating to pair with food, and you know, if it's a rainy day, I just want something really easy.
There's one thing about that people talk about tea and coffee together, but one thing really special about tea is you can pair perfectly with food.
Yeah, it's very, very food friendly.
Right. So that's another thing. Like people say, drink coffee caffeine, but then there's different effects. But I think,
coffee is a baby compared to tea. Coffee has only been around for the last 200 years.
Mm.
You know, that is, it's tea's been around for at least 4,000 years, 2,000 years mainly. But the only product that I could say really is as close to tea is wine.
Mm.
It's the only product that has the same age, the same sophistication in cultivation, and the same sophistication in processing.
Mm.
And I constantly make analogies. Like, you know, it's like wine. It's like wine. And it actually helps people to understand the depth and the realm of what tea can actually represent.
Mm, interesting. Okay. And the other aspect of the tea is that, and you sell ceramics too, right? And I saw your website, amazing, beautiful products. So, and I think you worked with 14th generation potter from Japan.
Actually, three of them.
Oh, really? Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, two of them are actually siblings, the Nakazato family. It's Taki and Hanako-san.
Mm.
And both of them, of course, come from a really, really well-established... They're pretty much rock stars as far as ceramics are concerned. Everybody knows them in the ceramic world. I knew of them. They were under my radar, but I thought that I wouldn't be able to really reach them because of how popular and how famous they are.
Mm.
But through a mutual acquaintance who had gone to school with Hanako's partner, I was actually made the introduction. So that actually changed it for me because, you know, like the same way with my tea producers, like I would like there to be this natural synergy, this kind of like natural relationship instead of just going and be like, hey, you know, I want your product or I think you're cool, whatever. So that worked out really well. And then through Hanako, I was able to reach Taki. Taki is an amazing artist. His teacups are a galaxy all on their own. And then the third longtime generation is the late Seijimon Tashiro, the 15th, who is from Soma. That story is actually really amazing. I had met him a year from the exact day that the tsunami happened in Japan. So it was actually March 11th of 2000, 9, mm-hmm. And I had purchased his wares. And then, unfortunately, a year later, 3 months after the tsunami, he had passed away. Mm. But he really inspired me to kind of reach out and to never underestimate my ability. He welcomed me into his showroom with his wife, and he worked with me, and I was able to purchase a few things. His cups I had purchased for one of my clients who raised horses. So the Somayaki tradition is to actually draw horses, left-facing horses, which is a very omedetai celebratory thing. But I still have one of his kyusus, which is a personal object of mine, and then I have a tea set. And he doesn't make tea sets normally. This was something that, even when I picked it up, it was already about 20 years old. But, yeah, thanks to him, it really helped me kind of, like, be a little braver in the Japanese ceramics.
Wow, so that's another deai, like meeting, special meeting. And so what are the criteria in choosing a great teacup?
Depends on what you want to put in it, first and foremost. So, you know, for an everyday cup that tends to be bigger, first you want to choose the size, right? And then after that, the shape. And you want to start first at the rim, the lips, the lip. So, you know, depending on the thinness, the shape, you want to look above into it so you can see the opening, how wide it is, how narrow it is. Then you want to look inside at the bottom of it, because sometimes potters put specific swirls or designs, which normally are missed because you're just looking at it from the top at an angle. So you always want to look inside. And then afterwards, you want to look at the bottom, the kodai, the foot, and where the body meets the foot, at what angle. That gives you a particular shape. I skipped this part, but probably the first thing you want to do is look at the outside and see what glaze you're attracted to, you know, and that's when you start getting separated into regions.
Right. So the texture and the feeling, taste, maybe.
You know, like Bizen has very dark with like kind of reddish glazes. Shiga and Iga, which is where I just recently went to in May, have this kind of glassification where, because they use wood firing, they bring the heat up so high that the glaze turns into glass and you actually see a ball of just bidoro, a glass, like cracked glass that's formed on there. Those are all traces of wood firing. And almost all of my ceramics are wood fired.
Okay.
And wood firing is really, really a pain. It takes about 7 to 10 days of constant firing, which means you have to use a lot of wood to continue firing. And not just the same wood. You know, the better the density, the better quality the wood, the higher the fire is going to be. So you need high, really, really high quality wood in order to get the fire up that high.
And labor. They have to constantly watch it. And
Basically, it's a 10-day drinking party. Because nobody you can't walk away. And they take turns. And it takes about 3 months to fill an entire kiln. So they're basically making for 3 months, they're drying, and then they finally, okay, we have enough to fill it, let's fill the kiln. And even then, you have to already know that you're probably going to lose about maybe 10 or 20% of it. Naturally, some stuff is going to crack, some is just going to fall. You just never know what's going to happen, but it takes a long time.
Wow, so precious. Right. Okay, and then now, so you have a website, beautiful website, which I really like and easy to navigate, but now you have a retail store.
Yes.
So maybe you can tell us about that.
So my retail store is located inside of a Japanese restaurant called 108. It's been around for about 7 years, really well established, kind of hidden. It's, you know, not very well advertised or anything like that, which I actually like.
It's in Williamsburg.
Yes, it's in Williamsburg. It's on South 2nd and Wythe. It's been there for quite some time. It's kind of like a local favorite, so a lot of the locals don't want to tell anybody about it. So a lot of people have found out about it because the sushi chef was actually pretty well known. But the owner and I have known each other for a really long time. When I was working for the Japanese tea company, he was actually one of our first wholesale accounts at Bozu, which is a long time Williamsburg business. And I was a customer of theirs for a long time, and one day I saw this empty space, and the vision just came to me, and I went up to him and I said, "Hey, Shinji-san, how about we work together? I build you a menu for your restaurant based on tea." He was kind of scared because he knew my prices, and he was like, okay, let's try it." I said, "Well, if anything happens, like, you know, I'll take care of it. Don't worry about it. No one's going to lose out on this." And he was brave enough to do it. I set up shop. I started doing tea classes or tastings, very informal. Mm-hmm. And then now the restaurant has an amazing tea selection, which I learn from every day because I can firsthand see like customers' reactions to the tea that is being served. Nice. But it's tailored specifically to their food.
Okay.
Yeah.
So maybe you can tell us how it's tailored. Like,
the restaurant's really unique because it has the traditional sushi restaurant, but it also has, we have two chefs. We have the sushi chef, and then we have the chef de cuisine, Hide-san, and he was trained at Alain Ducasse and David Boulay. Mm-hmm. So he has a really, really strong French background, and he uses Japanese techniques with some traditional Japanese ingredients to make these amazing dishes. So it has to be really roundabout. I can't just serve Japanese green tea. Mm-hmm. I serve, you know, some of the Korean green teas, I serve black teas. There's two occasions when I'm really, really excited at the restaurant. One, when someone at the sushi counter asks me what I recommend to pair their sushi dinner with, and I pull out a Darjeeling. They're expecting green, but, you know, they don't really expect Darjeeling to have that depth. And then when they see that it matches perfectly with the soy sauce, their whole, like, what they thought about the limitation of what tea was, it's completely taken away. Like, it brings them to a completely different level.
Interesting. I have to think of that, like the soy and the Darjeeling. I'm going to try that definitely.
Black tea, like the maltiness of the black tea and the maltiness of soy sauce have a really beautiful relationship. It's they're delicious together.
Right. Well, maybe you should write a book. Pairing, seriously.
And then the other time I'm really surprises when I can actually get a Japanese person to trust me about a really high selection of Japanese green tea. Japanese customers are the most difficult to kind of convince because for them, tea is not a novelty. Tea is an everyday thing, you know? So they don't consider paying $9 for a pot of tea at a restaurant. You know, for them, it's like it should be automatically free.
Right.
But when someone takes so much care to really pick out something really special that even within Japan is hard to find, it's great when they discover something new. It's really inspiring.
Right. So I think, it's amazing. Like anything else, sake, ramen, everything now being elevated to the higher level.
Yeah, definitely.
Right. Okay, and I heard you have a great clients like 118, of course, and the new Rouge Tomate, Chelsea, and Akashi, which I think is a great sushi place, and you're amazing, so congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Okay, and so I think we'll take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll talk about Stefan's very serious tea samurai training. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's unique store in Lower Manhattan is home to perhaps the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan, plus the rarest natural sharpening stones and exquisitely designed tableware. They also host special events such as knife sharpening demonstrations and parties with New York's most famous chefs and restaurateurs. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the implicit and elegance of Japanese culture to your table, be it in your home or in the finest restaurant. For more information, visit Korin.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from our studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is Stefan Ramirez, who is the founder and tea specialist at Tea Dealers, which he started in 2005. And Stefan is also an experienced traditional tea practitioner of the Rasenke School. So you offer staff training and education about tea for your clients. So how do you find the knowledge level and interest in tea right now?
I think that the interest is really high. They have some knowledge because of their cultural background. So maybe, you know, that's one of the beauties of tea is that the cultural, it's so deeply ingrained in different cultures. So they've been around it. But unfortunately, their exposure to it is very, very limited. Mm. And that sometimes becomes very difficult.
Right. So how do you educate people? Like, the biggest challenge in training people?
It's just getting them comfortable with the product and showing them many different types of product. Just by explaining to them that, you know, black tea, green tea, oolong are all the same teas, mm-hmm. it helps to kind of start to understand mm-hmm. what tea is. But just demystifying everything and just simplifying everything so that they're not so overwhelmed by it. Like, yeah, this tea might be very, very expensive, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you can't learn how to handle it.
Mm.
So just, yeah, increasing the knowledge and just making them confident about how simple tea is, because it's actually a lot easier to make tea than it is to make, like, those crazy coffee faces, those latte things.
That's true. Right. And I heard that you also offer public presentations for schools, government-sponsored programs, museums, and other places. So it sounds like there's a demand for tea education.
Yeah, and also, you know, I like to talk about tea through culture. I think that's what makes it so deep and so such a strong subject, that it's not just a simple product.
Mm.
And through that avenue, I can kind of really venture off into a lot of different subjects to just keep the listener interested, you know, whether it's food, whether it's wine, historically, the historical importance in tea. So there's a lot to talk about, and I like to really kind of like venture out outside of just restaurants, you know, because that's where you can get people to kind of really focus.
Right. So it's beyond the taste, it's the stories that you are talking about.
Stories are nice, but I think there's it's fact, you know, there's a lot of things that people just don't, and sometimes they don't even realize it. So I like to really kind of like make them aware of where it stands.
Right. Okay. And also, this is interesting. I heard that you practice traditional tea ceremony, as I said earlier. So when and why did you start your practice?
So I started tea ceremony with Urasenke right after I stopped working at the tea shop. I wanted to keep tea close to me because I had no, like I said before, I didn't have any intention to actually continue a tea company or anything like that. So I wanted to keep it close to me. And at the time, there was a teacher there at Urasenke who was really, really well respected, and he allowed me in. I kind of skipped a 2-year waiting list, and I started to practice there. It's at 69th and Lexington. It's called Urasenke, New York. It was built in the early 70s, and it's in Rothko's old artist studio. So it's like a 18th century carriage house. It's absolutely beautiful. It's probably the most complete tea dojo or tea like chashitsu in the world.
Okay.
They actually flew in 3 buildings and rebuilt them by hand inside of that. Most of the people who worked on that building are no longer even alive anymore.
Wow.
But it's gorgeous. They offer to the public like a simple tea tasting once a month. So you go in, I think you pay like $15-$20, and you can be in the room, and then one of the teachers and one student will actually make traditional tea ceremony for you, really simple, and you can learn a little bit about it. But if you are interested in learning about Chana Yu and tea ceremony, you could ask them questions right there and then.
Okay. So then, that was. But you went there regularly, like a weekly basis, or something?
Yeah,
serious?
It's not cheap. and it's also, it takes quite a bit of a dedication, and most people don't think about it, but it's there's actually a lot of physical aspect to it. So because you have to sit on your knees in a seiza style or cross-legged, it can be very difficult. So for people who have knee problems, it may not be the easiest thing to do. So I kind of really try to warn people about that. I recently had a knee injury, so it kind of like put me out of business for a little bit as far as in the tea room. But yeah, it's strenuous. I recently actually I was talking to a yoga teacher, and she asked me what I did for a regular basis, and I told her about my tea ceremony. She actually likened it to a practice. And when I started to think about it, and I realized that that's exactly what it is. It's not just drinking tea. It's not just meditation. It's really putting these certain ideals into practice on an everyday basis through everything that I do. And it takes a certain amount of dedication and a certain amount of strength to be able to do it on a regular basis.
So, but because it's said by the yoga teacher, practice means breathing to mental to something physical too.
Practice is deep. A practice is everything that you learn to put it into direct use in your everyday life. It's not just like what you do in the room is just, that's the practicing. That's just going through the steps. But then applying that into your everyday life, that's when it takes on life.
Ah, okay. So in a way, it's life changing.
Yeah, it is. If that's why I said you should, it needs to be taken seriously, because if not, you won't take it, like you won't really want to do it very long.
Right. My former guest is on episode 51, Keiko Kitazawa Koch. She is actually Omotesenkei sensei. But she said 10 things that changed by tea ceremony. I was on the episode, but it's amazing. It's really a conversion of something in your mind.
And it's lifelong. It is really, really lifelong. One of the most amazing aspects of it is that it changes as you get older, because obviously your body can't do certain things, and your mind works different ways. So your practice and the tea ceremony actually changes with you as well.
Interesting. So deep.
Very deep.
Right. And to make it even deeper, you went to Kyoto.
Yes.
Right, on sabbatical. And you can maybe tell us about that?
Yeah, so there's this program that's been established since the early 70s. It's called Midorikai, and it basically, it's for tea students who already have been studying tea and can be referred by their teacher to study at the 400-year-old complex and study directly with the teachers there.
Right. So you have to be outside Japan.
Yes,
right?
You have to be outside of Japan. It's for foreigners. It's bilingual, so you don't need to speak Japanese. And it's very, very intensive. You're there for a year. Your Monday through Friday is completely planned out. In the mornings, you receive lectures about the history.
What time do you start? Like, what time do you start in the morning?
I start around like 8:30 in the morning.
Sorry.
And yeah, lectures, and then we have lunch, and then right after lunch, we go into the chashitsu, the tea room, and then we have okeiko, or tea practice, for about 3 hours, which is kneeling most of the time. And then after that, we have chores, and then you have to be in the dorm room by 9:45. Every single day.
Right.
And so the next day, you have to kind of start all over again.
No nightlife.
No nightlife. No, I mean, there's very little time for anything. So, like, that's why I try to discourage people. Like, it's not an opportunity to go and, like, oh, yeah, so I can go to, to other parts of Japan and this and that. It doesn't really allow very much time for that.
So, in a way, it's like a monk.
Yeah, it's a part-time monk situation.
So what did you learn from the sabbatical?
Dedication and what it takes to actually be able to do that on a regular basis. And Not only that, but also seeing the people behind it, what it takes to make this tea organization and tea, and, you know, because they work with so many people. They work with the flower people for flower arrangement. They work with potters. They work with people who make incense, the people who make the sweets, the people who make... So seeing all those people and seeing how everything works together almost as a system, it made me realize that because I work with potters and because I work with tea people, I have a level of responsibility in representing them. I'm almost like an ambassador. So... It showed me how much responsibility I have, and it makes that's why I'm so serious, but at the same time so passionate about it. It's because, you know, everybody that I meet and everything that I bring here has a lot of meaning to me, and it's my focus to kind of really represent them.
Right. So you learned the mission through this ceremony in a way. Right. That's amazing. Okay, and that's it's a little different subject, but I heard you said you offer free tea classes at 108.
Yes.
Right.
On Sunday evenings and Tuesday evenings, I have tea tastings. They're more informal. I think classes is too formal. You can come in anytime from, you know, you can sit as long as you'd like. You can have as much tea as you can take. you can stay for the whole thing if you'd like. To find out about them, you can go at the bottom of our website. There's you can subscribe to our newsletter, and then also you follow us on Instagram. And every week I change it up. I make it really, really for New Yorkers lifestyle, so you can pick and choose exactly what you want to come into. If you can't make it one day, there's another day. But yeah, you know, I'm doing a lot of exciting things, working with different people, just making it as interesting as possible.
So far, what kind of people come to your classes?
It's really wide. I mean, I get a range from 20 to 60. You know, I get 20-year-olds who don't know anything about alcohol. They don't drink, but they like tea, and they want to know more about tea. Then I have, you know, hardworking professionals who want an alternative. And then I have just tea geeks who just want to know what I'm carrying and how it's different from everything else. And I have a lot of wine people, like sommeliers and producers. Again, because, you know, wine and tea have the closest relationship to each other. So they're able to understand a lot of the things that I'm throwing out there.
Wow. But, you know, when you started your business 11 years ago, that was not the time, like, tea just started to be more getting attention.
Yeah.
Right? So, obviously, according to the demographics of your clients and, the, you know, people come to your classes, it's changing.
It is. I think probably in the next 10 years, what we're going to see is there's going to be a lot more green tea in the market. Right now, you know, we're still predominantly black tea. But I think that there's going to be a huge increase. And green tea isn't just, you know, it's matcha, it's the oolongs and a lot of those things. So they're all kind of like put together into the same group. But yeah, I think in the next 10 years, people are going to be drinking a lot more green tea than black.
Right. And, well, people say it's healthier too.
They're all healthy, you know. They all have a different benefit. That's the amazing thing about the plant. As it changes, the chemical the composition changes, and it gives you something different. There's no such thing as bad tea.
I suppose it's well made with exactly. love.
Yes.
Right. So, okay. So, what's your plan for the next?
I want to continue to working to doing bigger collaborations with people. I mean, that's what I've been doing recently outside of the restaurant world, you know, with spas and holistic centers and just being able to reach out to as many people as possible and making them aware that, you know, this product is here. You know, we are a great gateway to the start of things, to learn more about tea and to go deeper into tea. but I'm really inspired by the collaborations that I've been doing recently. Like one of them is this local spa called Lanshin, and we've just written up on Vogue.com, which we never intended it to be that way. But again, it's because of the natural synergy that is there, and the just doing something passionate and working together, and bigger, stronger collaborations.
Sounds like it is a part of a lifestyle.
It is, yes, exactly.
Okay, great. So thank you for joining us today, Stefan.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
So listeners, if you'd like to know more about Stefan's activities, please visit tdealers.com. That is t-dealers.com. And if you have any questions or comments about the show, or suggestions for guests or topics of the show, please contact us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org. And Japan Eats is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, and Stitcher podcasts. And please go to iTunes and Stitcher and write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Today's show was made possible by Corin, and our engineer is David Tadasuyore. I'll thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.